Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues, and welcome to this inaugural lecture. I think it's a fine and honourable tradition of academic life that part of the price one pays on elevation to a professorship is to give an inaugural lecture to your colleagues, many of whom are often somewhat uncertain about what it is you actually profess, and all of whom are, I think it's fair to say, delighted to be enlightened by their newfound professor. Of course, at the LSE, this is a relatively new innovation. I mean, it only goes back a decade or so. And there are, in fact, a number of very distinguished professors at the LSE who have evaded this obligation, most famously Sir Karl Popper, who managed to be here for more than a couple of decades without managing to give an inaugural lecture. However, these hard managerial times, I tell you, things have changed, and Michael's only been a professor for 5 years, so we're getting better, and on this performance indicator, I think that I can rate a little bit higher than some of my predecessors. It's a tough world now, I tell you, at the LSE. So welcome to this inaugural lecture. And I should tell you just a little about our lecturer. Michael Liefer is Professor of International Relations. He's also pro-director of the school, as many of you know. He was a student here, and he joined the staff in 1969. He's held posts at the University of Adelaide, South Australia, and at the University of Hull in the United Kingdom, and was for a time a part-time advisor in the Research Department of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. He's also held visiting appointments at the ANU, the Australian National University, the University of the Philippines, Cornell University, and the National University of Singapore. He's the general editor of a series of books on politics in Asia for Routledge, and sits on the editorial boards of Pacific Affairs and the Pacific Review. He's also a member of the advisory board of the Centre for Southeast Asian Studies of the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, and of the Southeast Asian Committee of the British Academy, and of the Programme on International Studies in Washington. Most recently here at the LSE, he's been closely involved in establishing a new research centre for the economy, politics and society of Asia. By any stretch, he is therefore well known both nationally and internationally as one of those experts on Pacific affairs. He's written numerous books, most recently on Indonesia's foreign policy in 1983, The Balance of Power in East Asia, 86, and how he's done it, I don't know, but whilst he's been pro-director, he's completed a dictionary of the modern politics of Southeast Asia, as an example to all pro-directors to be. So, without more ado, I invite Professor Liefer to give his inaugural lecture on East Asian values and the politics of enlargement.
Thank you, Director. When I first came to this school as a student, the then lone and scholarly Professor of International Relations used to expend a great deal of his energy and time seeking to justify the profession of his subject within and without the institution. He did so employing an imaginative but idiosyncratic idiom which was not always well appreciated by his departmental colleagues, and certainly less so by those on the other side of departmental bounds. That sense of intellectual embattlement experienced and registered by the late Charles Manning no longer burdens and constrains students of international relations in the school. Moreover, a number of Manning's distinctive contributions have stood the test of time and scholarship through the writings of some of his pupils and one-time colleagues. Today, members of the International Relations Department at the school pursue their common and diverse interests with an evident sense of intellectual legitimacy and self-confidence, free from the legacy of past embattlement. There is no longer the need to justify professing the subject of international relations, but it is important to ensure that intellectual interests pursued in its name bear a clear relationship to its general characteristics. My own interests have been regionally located, but have been hopefully pursued in the manner self-prescribed, which brings me to the subject of this lecture. It is a subject that is contemporary, fashionable, and regionally located. But it is also one that is not necessarily bound by particular time or place. It goes to the heart of the study of international relations at this school, which has been from the outset, primarily, but not exclusively, about the relationships between so-called sovereign states, whose rights have in the main taken precedence over those of the citizens who inhabit them. Increasingly at issue, however, has been the balance of rights between states and those of the people residing within them, giving rise to a tension which is inherent in the topic which I shall discuss this evening. The purpose of this lecture is to address the debate over the universality of values which has entered into international discourse since the end of the Cold War, particularly with the advent of the administration of Bill Clinton in Washington in January 1993. The topic of universality is not new in itself, as I hope to demonstrate, but it is one which enjoys a measure of novelty in the way in which it has come to the fore after the end of the Cold War, with special reference to those states in East Asia which have been distinguished by their remarkable economic performances. In addressing this subject, I shall pose three questions. First, what kinds of values are contested or are being contested? Secondly, how might those values enter into the relationships of states and with what effects? And finally, what kinds of issues are raised in consequence for students of international relations? Let me offer some tentative answers at the outset. First, I would suggest that the values in contention are of two general kinds. It is possible to identify one kind of democratic values relating to individual worth, which derives from the historical roots of Western democracy. For example, in the formative case of the English Revolution, the argument for democracy was based on the Protestant belief that all men and women were created equal in the sight of God, a belief reaffirmed three centuries later in the preamble to the United Nations Charter. In essence, what is being enjoined is respect for the sanctity of human life, which is then extended to its general condition to be operationally expressed in the argument that all people have a right to have their views represented over decisions which affect the general circumstances of their lives. Applied universally, this argument may be subversive of the traditional concept of state sovereignty insofar as it provides a basis for external as well as internal questioning of the acts and legitimacy of an incumbent government. In this respect, I would draw your attention to a countervailing East Asian example from before the end of the Cold War. During the height of the conflict over Cambodia, the government of Singapore took the lead as a member of the regional body, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, in refuting the argument that human rights violations could be a basis for challenging the representation at the United Nations of Democratic Kampuchea, better known as the Khmer Rouge. It was asserted strongly and with success that a satisfactory record in human rights was not one of the criteria by which the credentials of a delegation to the General Assembly could be approved or rejected. And this example, taken in context, offers a demonstration of how the balance of power determined the balance of rights. An alternative set of values may be imputed to some East Asian states, although it would seem to be impossible to sustain any argument for a single East Asian set, given the human and cultural diversity of that geographic zone. Indeed, the values employed in contestation are neither from the Islamic or Buddhist traditions, which have not been held up within East Asia by national political leaders as models for emulation. Possible exception would be the case of the Sultanate of Brunei in northern Borneo, where the concept of a Malay Islamic monarchy serves as a convenient doctrine justifying despotic rule, while only next month the Malaysian government is sponsoring an international seminar on the values which Islam may have in common with Chinese codes of ethics such as Confucianism. Now, in effect, the alternative set of values are drawn from the Confucian tendency, but for the sake of convenience, I will call this alternative set shared values, which was the title of a white paper introduced into Singapore's parliament in January 1990, coincident with the end of the Cold War. The justification for taking this Singaporean version is that its protagonists have been the most vocal and influential internationally in challenging the appropriateness of Western values for East Asian societies and political orders, and in offering an East Asian model as an alternative. There were five values identified in Singapore's white paper, but the first and of overriding importance was the axiom, to quote, "nation before community and society before self," which will not be unfamiliar to students of Europe in the 1930s. To put matters in context, the white paper in question was not provoked by Western rhetoric, but represented a considered governmental response to a disturbing Christian religious revivalism, which may be explained as a social consequence of remarkable and rapid economic development. A so-called Marxist-Leninist plot to make Singapore into a classless society, uncovered in 1987, had been laid at the feet of a group of Catholic social workers. Irrespective of the validity of the charge, the government was undoubtedly concerned that the contagion of liberation theology, then rampant in the Philippines, might spread to Singapore as a reaction to its society becoming over-addicted to Western materialist values. The promulgation of shared values has to be seen together with legislation to promote religious harmony enacted at the end of 1990 as an instrument of domestic social control and not as a specific response to a so-called Western ideological initiative. Shared values as promulgated in Singapore would seem to be in accord with the Confucian ethic and tradition, which, for example, the Chinese government has found it convenient to employ to fill a conspicuous ideological void. Moreover, Singapore's former Prime Minister, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, accepted the office of honorary chairman at the founding conference of the International Confucian Association, which convened in Beijing last October. That Confucian tradition is not revered in neighboring Malaysia, however, where it has been explicitly repudiated by Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim. Nor has it been extolled in neighboring Indonesia as a justification for a democracy which exists in political form and not in any substance. And I should explain also that shared values was not intended as an open repudiation of democracy. In Singapore, the political system of democracy is endorsed and upheld by the ruling People's Action Party, but in a mandatory form, whereby a government re-elected at regular intervals should not have to be bothered with the likes of organized pressure groups and an investigative and critical press. The point about so-called shared values is that irrespective of their philosophical source, a number of governments in East Asia have found it politic to join in support of the arguments employed under a heading specific to Singapore. In response to the second question about how contested values may enter into the relations of states, they may do so to the extent that one state or set of states seeks to promote or impose values about the sanctity and condition of life on other states, which may then affect their domestic political orders to the disadvantage and objection of incumbent governments. Such employment of values in the form of conditions imposed for aid and trade may also place the states in question under disadvantage internationally in pursuit of their economic interests. And this kind of linkage may be identified, for example, in the external relations of the European Union, arising from the European Parliament seeking to insist on the presence of a human rights and social clause before ratifying a trade agreement. Finally, the issues raised in debates for students of international relations would seem to follow logically from the answers to the first two questions, and I will do no more now than point these up. First of all, there is the proverbial matter of the sanctity of sovereign jurisdiction, which most governments have always sought to protect. In the case of East Asia, one can identify a conventional possessiveness over sovereignty, including, for example, an insistence on the right to employ corporal punishment, to detain without trial, to hang drug traffickers, to control wage rates and trade union activity, as well as to determine environmental policy in the interest of protecting an international comparative advantage. In addition, the realm of sovereignty includes the claim right to be able to engineer without restraint the domestic, social, and political climate in order to counter the consequences of rapid economic changes, which some governments deem a threat to the political system of developmental authoritarianism, which has brought those changes about. And such a system of developmental authoritarianism, which is characteristic of a significant part of East Asia, may be described as one in which the state intervenes to impose and ensure political demobilization in the declared interests of social stability and economic development. This domestic aspect of sovereign jurisdiction is closely connected with a second issue, namely the interrelationship between international and domestic politics. Governments which have challenged the appropriateness of so-called Western values wish to be able to define the terms of discourse in which they conduct their international relationships so as to be able to insulate their domestic orders from political contagion inimical to developmental or other kinds of authoritarianism, including those which have been carried over with an evident vulnerability from the Cold War. And in the course of debate, there's been a clear attempt to invest so-called distinctive East Asian values with a philosophical robustness and an international legitimacy which can withstand any ideological challenges posed by Western governments and, of course, Western media, while continuing to enjoy the benefits of export access to Western markets. The nature of argument employed by East Asian protagonists in the debate exposes the structural tension between the rights of states as notional persons with legal personality and the rights of persons in a flesh and blood sense. The East Asian reaction and case, however disingenuous and rationalized, is based paradoxically on a claim to linked concepts of equality and diversity. Governments which demand an equality of sovereign jurisdiction with respect to a common statehood insist also that such a common statehood exhibits economic, social, and cultural diversities which should be acknowledged and respected, so denying the universal application of common values. The argument has been put succinctly by an Indonesian academic who is a graduate of our International Relations Department, was referred to the concept of human rights as too narrow and too alien. In dispute is the matter of standards to be applied among a humanity assumed to be common, which was the basis of the post-Pacific War challenge to a Western colonialism established on the assumption of a racial superiority. Before proceeding any further, it's necessary to pose and answer yet another question, namely, how novel is this kind of debate? The answer is that the debate is not novel in essence, but there are novel elements to it. Values have always been an integral part of the discourse between peoples organized in differing forms of governance, with the prevalence of one set over another likely to have been determined by force of arms, as demonstrated by the experience of colonialism. With evolution and consolidation of an international society of states, a tension has developed, however, between values as the prerogative of states, which they arrogate the right to define unilaterally within their separate jurisdictions, and values as the common expression of an embryonic, single international community. The appearance of this kind of tension may be identified in the latter stage of the historical process, whereby international society has expanded from a European core, but it has been registered in the main through the gruesome and harrowing experiences of the 20th century. Now, with that temporal context in mind, I would draw your attention to a significant contrast between the kinds of values articulated as universal in the Covenant of the League of Nations and those in the Charter of the United Nations. The Covenant, which registered the effective inauguration of international governance, concentrated on defining a code of conduct between governments which would be conducive to international order. But it is necessary to read down to Article 23 before the human condition is addressed, at least up to a point. The Charter had the same prime purpose as the Covenant, but went beyond its scope in its preamble by explicitly reaffirming faith in fundamental human rights represented as the equal heritage of all men and women. The reasons why the Charter went beyond the Covenant in defining responsibility that intrude into the domestic jurisdiction of states are too well known to warrant rehearsing here. They lie in the bitter experiences of the Second World War, and to an extent also in initiatives under the League of Nations, which sought to extend the scope of responsibilities of governments within their domestic domains. That redefinition of responsibilities did not go unchallenged, however, with the onset of the Cold War, which was represented on both sides as a struggle between the appropriate values that ought to inform all states. The West, led by a United States that effectively controlled the General Assembly of the United Nations in its early years, took the lead in establishing the United Nations Commission on Human Rights and in promoting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which drew heavily on English, French, and American codes and experiences. And that view of human rights was subject to challenge from the communist world, which regarded it as a vehicle for subverting their political orders. The simplified basis of the challenge was that the values enthroned took little of any account of the economic dimension of rights without which their political expression would be meaningless. And that challenge began to attract support beyond the Cold War divide as the process of decolonization brought new states into the General Assembly, which faced fundamental problems of economic development, which the West was said to have an obligation to help address. And as you well know, in the event, human rights found further general expression in the mid-1960s in two separate covenants on civil and political and on economic, social and cultural rights. But the issue of how to cope with the logic of a common humanity has never been resolved satisfactorily in the relationships of separate governments. The point of this digression is to demonstrate that the debate over values, which has been prompted by strongly expressed views in East Asia, is hardly a novelty in the second half of the 20th century. It has come to enjoy a special salience since the end of the Cold War, which in one respect has left the United States as the sole superpower. During the Cold War, the United States, which is a highly ideological country, was concerned to make the world safe for democracy. However, its governments were prepared to make exceptions where dictatorial and brutal regimes were part of Washington's wall of containment against international communism, which included states in East Asia. The end of the Cold War and the breakup of the Soviet Union was seen as releasing the United States from constraints which had denied it the opportunity to act according to its founding values. And with the election of Bill Clinton, the Cold War policy of containing Soviet-led communism was not only declared defunct, but in its place was substituted that of the enlargement of free market democracy. And to that end, beginning in September 1993, President Clinton, his Secretary of State Warren Christopher, and his National Security Assistant Anthony Lake made a series of coordinated policy statements which sought to redefine the essence of American foreign policy in terms of the idiom of enlargement, hence the title of this lecture. And the best articulation of that new policy may be found in a speech entitled From Containment to Enlargement, delivered by Anthony Lake at Johns Hopkins University in September 1993. That speech merits some attention. At the outset, Lake explained that with the end of the Cold War, there was no longer a consensus among the American people about why, and even whether, their nation should remain actively engaged in the world. He argued that it was necessary to communicate anew why that engagement was essential. And the reasoning employed was a combination of the ideological and the pragmatic. He began by invoking so-called core values of democracy and market economies, which flow from the American Declaration of Independence, and linking these directly to the conduct of foreign policy. He explained, quote him, "As we fought aggressors and contained communism, our engagement abroad was animated both by calculations of power and by this belief, to the extent that democracy and market economies hold sway in other nations, our own nation will be more secure, prosperous and influential, while the broader world will be more humane and peaceful." Lake went on to say, invoking in passing, to quote him, "the most profound insights of Woodrow Wilson, throughout the Cold War, we contained a global threat to market democracies. Now we should seek to enlarge their reach, particularly in places of special significance to us. The successor to a doctrine of containment must be a strategy of enlargement, enlargement of the world's free community of market economies." According to Anthony Lake, the object of American foreign policy was still to make the world safe for democracy and American business, but the change of context enabled that goal to be addressed in a seemingly more consistent manner. He did add, however, in a less publicized part of his speech, quote him, "that our strategy must be pragmatic. Our interests in democracy and markets do not stand alone. Other interests at times will require us to be friendly and even defend non-democratic states for mutually beneficial reasons." Now, that said, the doctrine of enlargement was reiterated by President Clinton in an address before the United Nations General Assembly a week later. And it was also given intellectual underpinning and momentum by the influential contributions of Francis Fukuyama and Samuel Huntington, who registered a renewed American confidence in democratic values at the end of the Cold War, as well as some of the accompanying triumphalism. The reaction and challenge to that revival of the conventional political wisdom of the West has come primarily from within newly industrialized East Asia, which has been analyzed by the World Bank under the heading of the East Asian Miracle. Underpinning the arguments employed against the universal merits of Western values, which have been put forcibly in Singapore in particular, has been the success of the model of political economy, which has been described previously as developmental authoritarianism. It has been argued that where communism failed to deliver its material promise, with its disciples now obliged to recant fallible dogmas, East Asian political systems have generated amazing growth rates, aided in part by not having to carry the burden of Western forms of social welfare, regarded as a millstone around the neck of developing economies. The East Asian reaction has been based on an international recognition of its newfound economic power in a context of Western economic recession. And Reginald Dale, writing last May in the International Herald Tribune, pointed out, to quote him, that after years in which the West has talked down to them, many Asians feel they have finally tipped the scales of history in their favor. And such a view seemed to be confirmed by the Permanent Secretary of Singapore's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, speaking recently in Davos, who pointed out in the true spirit of shared values, to quote him, "All human rights covenants were created when the West was in power. In the future, these agreements will assert the rights of society over the rights of individuals." It has been suggested also reaction to the promulgation of the doctrine and policy of enlargement, that Asian societies exhibit values which have been conducive to civil discipline and stable political orders, which have an underlying responsibility for the astounding economic achievements registered over the last quarter of a century. Unlike in the West, where the individual is the centerpiece of democracy, which is a system designed to disempower government, in Asia, the tradition is one of respect for authority, with the individual under a strong obligation to the group or society. That tradition, embodied in Singapore's notion of shared values, is said to be most pertinent where the legacy of Confucian values persists, including among the overseas Chinese communities within Southeast Asia, who have been responsible for considerable wealth creation within societies where the dominant culture is not necessarily Confucian. Furthermore, it's been argued that post-war attempts by the West to export their values constitute a political impertinence. They not only represent resented intrusions into the domestic jurisdiction of sovereign states, but also because of the social pathology of the West, reflected, for example, in urban decay, family disintegration, drug abuse, and high crime rates, hardly constitute a basis for a new civilizing mission at the expense of East Asia. In addition, the premise of enlargement is said to fail to take proper account of the condition of countries beset by ethnic and other social tensions, where statehood has often preceded an unrealized nationhood, and where there is only a limited and fragile sense of political community. Western values are deemed to be both inappropriate and premature in circumstances where it is better to foster strong and good government in order to allow a firm economic base to be established as a foundation for gradual political change. Among surviving communist regimes, enlargement has been depicted as a dark scheme of imperialist and international reactionary forces. And from that perspective, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Vietnam has pointed out that it was strange that some of those who advocate human rights as a cornerstone of international relations pay so little regard to differences in stages of socioeconomic development and the ensuing differences in the perceptions of imperatives and the setting of national priorities. He's argued that a starving country will be far more concerned with feeding its people rather than with the forms and methods of democracy. And in a corresponding vein, the permanent secretary of Singapore's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to refer to him again, has taken particular delight in quoting from John Stuart Mill in order to support his argument that the West, in placing the promotion of democracy before that of economic development, has muddled its priorities. Now, this debate over the universality of values has not been simply one between East Asia and the West. For example, in May 1993, a meeting was convened in Bangkok of 49 Asian governments in preparation for the World Conference for Human Rights, which met in Vienna in the following month. And the so-called Declaration of Bangkok affirmed a regional adherence to the basic United Nations principles of universality and indivisibility of political, civil, economic, social, and cultural rights, but then went on to stress the need to consider human rights in national and regional contexts, as well as emphasizing the principles of respect for national sovereignty and non-interference in internal affairs. And that declaration specifically opposed the use of human rights as a condition for development assistance. At the same meeting, representatives were present of more than 170 Asian non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, who met for 5 days before the intergovernmental conference and expressed an unqualified support for the principles of universality and indivisibility of human rights, and who argued that international solidarity for human rights transcended national sovereignty. Moreover, at the end of the intergovernmental meeting, their collective concern was expressed at the emphasis on so-called regional specificities and what was perceived as the absence of an unequivocal statement regarding the universality and indivisibility of human rights. And it's important to take full cognizance of the rise of the NGO phenomenon in many countries in East Asia. I mean, their advent may have been inspired by Western example, but their appearance, expansion, and activism over a range of issues has been a product of social changes exclusive to those countries attendant on economic development. And I should point out also that the East Asian reaction to the debate over enlargement has not been uniform among regional governments. For example, the Japanese have not been vocal in support of counterparts from Singapore who have challenged Western conventional wisdom. Moreover, President Fidel Ramos of the Philippines has remarked with characteristic flourish that authoritarianism is a receding tide. We Filipinos cannot ride to development even if we wanted to. While the current government of Thailand, which also owes its legitimacy to an expression of people power which faced down military repression, has not sought to hide behind the cloak of shared values. And even Malaysia's Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim has taken issue with the alternative conventional wisdom that political liberalism is incompatible with strong economic performances. And South Korea and Taiwan may be cited also as examples of states where development and democracy are not now seen as incompatible. Now, those last examples of South Korea and Taiwan have also been used by opponents of Western values to demonstrate that strong and good government is required first in order to generate the development necessary to underpin democratic political change. I mean, the opponents of enlargement would argue that both East Asian countries have picked their own time and stages of development to accelerate the pace of democratization, and that they demand the right to do the same. For example, the government of Singapore has openly refused to be propelled down the same path of political change taken by Taiwan and South Korea, and has also indicated its resentment of the intrusion into its jurisdiction by President Clinton in his attempt to set aside the legal process in the case of Michael Fay. Moreover, the opponents of enlargement have argued that the motives of the West are less than pure, and part of the object is to subvert the comparative economic advantage of newly industrializing East Asia so as to deny its resident states the full opportunity for economic development based on export-led growth. For example, Malaysia's Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, who has become the co-author with the controversial Shintaro Ishihara of a book entitled The Asia That Can Say No, has castigated the West for its short working hours, its high wages, and luxurious lifestyle, and has by implication charged it with employing the weapon of human rights in economic warfare. He's also denounced the West for being bent on recolonization and has charged it with still being highly selective and hypocritical after the end of the Cold War, with the mixed examples of Bosnia and Algeria constantly cited, to which could be added that of Saudi Arabia, on which the United States has not sought to visit the benefits of democracy. And correspondingly, Britain's discovery very late in the day of the suitability of democracy for Hong Kong has been viewed by the government in Beijing as being equally inspired by base political motives. Now, centrally at issue in this debate is the obvious matter of sovereignty and the strict interpretation of Article 2, 1, and 2.7 of the United Nations Charter, with which some East Asian governments have challenged the doctrine of enlargement. Now, within that defense, there would seem to be a range of matters at issue, from a government's implied right to murder and torture its own citizens, because it is the internationally legitimate government, to the more plausible claim that economic development in states which have not yet consolidated their political communities requires a framework of orderly guided democracy and not the rumbustious and destabilizing variety of Western provenance. Clearly, in rehearsing these arguments, we return to the structural tension between the rights of states in international society and the rights of individual people, who above all may require protection from their own governments. But the argument from East Asia is that unequal development means that universality must give way to diversity, at least for the time being. The obvious danger in accepting this argument at face value is that it enables those governments in East Asia which do murder and torture their own citizens to shelter beneath the protection provided by the skilled exponents of shared values. The subject at hand is one for recurrent debate, but it would also seem to have become increasingly academic in the year and a half since the Clinton administration first espoused the virtues of enlargement. The credibility of that government has been called into question recently by the American electorate, so that the assumed mandate to change the world would appear to have been withdrawn, certainly with someone like Jesse Helms in the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But well before that electoral reverse of last November, and indeed within weeks of promulgating the doctrine of enlargement, President Clinton failed to make any impact on China's President Jiang Zemin over his government's human rights record when he met him at the first APEC summit in Seattle. Even more humiliating was the visit of Warren Christopher to Beijing in March last year, when the Chinese government deliberately rounded up dissidents in a public display of unwillingness to be dictated to over human rights. And in the event in May, the United States government, under pressure from business interests, effectively set aside China's record on human rights and an election pledge in deciding to renew its most favored nation privileges, so compromising the policy of enlargement. And it is worth noting that subsequent American objections to China joining the new World Trade Organization on its formation last January have not been based on considerations of human rights, but on its failure to effectively reform its economy in line with those free trade principles which have informed the workings of the GATT. and the United States has now shown itself more willing to impose trade sanctions over intellectual property rights rather than those of the human variety, despite the findings of a recent report by the State Department that there has not been any improvement in China's human rights record. Beyond that retreat on policy, the Clinton administration may have huffed and puffed, but without any substantive effect in the Michael Fay case in Singapore, over which the balance of American opinion was clearly with the island state's government in caning the convicted delinquent. And correspondingly, Indonesia's brutal treatment of trade unionists last year did not lead to a threatened withdrawal of preferential trade privileges and did not prevent Bill Clinton from attending the second APEC summit in Bogor last November, at which he engaged in only a ritual dialogue with President Suharto over gross human rights violations in East Timor. Certainly, the American president's presence did not serve as a constraint on Indonesia's courts, with the leader of the country's sole independent trade union subsequently having his prison sentence extended for alleged incitement of workers to violence. In addition, the Clinton administration would even appear to have begun to reverse its hardline policy towards Myanmar or Burma, described by the State Department as one of the world's worst violators of human rights. And that reversal has been matched by the recent conduct of the British government towards the regime in Rangoon, but without any apparent success in securing the release from incarceration of Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. The debate over the universality of values would seem to have lost its initial momentum, in part because the goals which the United States has wished to achieve are within the domestic domains of states' concern. Correspondingly, the United States does not dispose of the power to change domestic orders, as it was readily able to do, for example, in the notable case of Japan after victory in the Pacific War, but not in the contrasting example of Vietnam. The point has been well made by Robert Manning and Paula Stern in a recent issue of Foreign Affairs that U.S. power in the Asia-Pacific is declining at a historical moment when the American stake in the region is rising. In fact, the Clinton administration has visibly drawn back from open confrontation over human rights with a number of East Asian states which are either important trading partners or long-standing members of the same political alignment through a realization of the self-defeating nature of its policy. And its revision followed, coincidentally or not, an unprecedented act of remonstration by Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, Winston Lord, which was communicated to Warren Christopher shortly before the renewal of China's most favored nation privileges. And Lord warned of the emerging malaise in America's relations in Asia and pointed out the extent to which the United States had become entangled in unnecessary quarrels with regional states with which it had an interest in pursuing a constructive relationship. The general trend of American policy since last May has been to revise the practical application of the doctrine of and policy of enlargement in line with the critique articulated by Winston Lord. The rationale of policy now is that the best way to promote human rights and democracy is by more trade and investment, which will generate economic growth and middle classes who will have an interest in democratic enlargement within their own society. That certainly is the conclusion that may be drawn from President Clinton's presence and conduct at the second APEC summit in Indonesia, which has an unsavory human rights record, and where one form of guided democracy under President Sukarno has been succeeded by another more effective form under President Suharto. American policy may have wavered and been compromised, but the issue of democratic values in the relations between states will undoubtedly remain on the international agenda, if only because such diverse bodies as Amnesty International, Asia Watch, the European Parliament, the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, and the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, among others, will insist on their inclusion. Indeed, the universality of values will be a matter for debate at the United Nations-sponsored World Summit for Social Development, to be held in Copenhagen next month. And there is also the prospect of a corresponding debate at the next Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Auckland in November. I would suggest also that the issue of universal values will be sustained in East Asia, but at least as much of a domestic as an international problem, to the extent that continuing economic development gives rise to continual social changes, which are likely to pose challenges to political orders based on developmental authoritarianism, hard and soft. Singapore's sensitivity to such challenge in mildest form was registered recently when Prime Minister Goh Chok Tong made it clear that local journalists had no right to question his governing style and that he was setting the out-of-bounds markers clearly so that everyone knows the limits of openness and consultation. Should East Asian states continue to record impressive growth rates, then the issue of the politics of enlargement is likely to become a far more practical matter for them than the United States, despite the ideological roots and thrust of its foreign policy. A Republican-dominated Congress may be expected to treat the idealist strain of American foreign policy in a less consistent way than its Democratic predecessor, so reverting to earlier Cold War practice. And while likely to take a tough line towards China over Tibet and Taiwan, for example, and towards Vietnam over missing in action, such a Congress will probably be more flexible in attitude towards authoritarian governments elsewhere in East Asia over human rights issues. The evident irony in all this is that the politics of enlargement may have been effectively abandoned by the West for the time being to the satisfaction of some East Asian governments, but the issue of contested values will not be expunged that readily from East Asian states irrevocably committed to market-driven economic development and engagement in the global economy. There's an important sense in which the participation of East Asian governments in the debate to define the moral terms of international discourse has always been a matter of internal purpose. That debate with the West has not necessarily been artificial, but it has certainly had a clear domestic function in the service of political demobilization. But such self-justification and self-service about differing and even double standards is likely to ring increasingly hollow within East Asia as economic change continues to drive social change, with the politics of enlargement more evidently translated to domestic arenas within the region. The direction and nature of attendant political change will, of course, remain problematic. But while Washington can switch the politics of enlargement on and off according to ideological imperative, those authoritarian governments which are a party to the East Asian miracle may find it increasingly difficult to enjoy such latitude within their sovereign domains or to seal them off from the international society into which they have become economically integrated.
I'd like to thank Professor Liefer on all our behalfs for what is, I think, by any standard, a fascinating example of what professing international relations means at the LSE, and now invite all of you to join us in an informal reception upstairs in the staff common room. Thank you very much.